Hi, welcome to Civic's Change Agent Chat, episode 13. During these chats, we speak with change agents who are working to create a better healthcare system for us all. I'm Stephanie Spriggs with the Center for Improving Value in Healthcare, or as we like to call it, Civic. In this chat, Carrie Frank, Civic's VP of Communication and Marketing, is speaking with a senior management analyst and an economist from the Denver Regional Council of Governments, known locally as Dr. Cog. Dr. Cog is the federally designated Area Agency on Aging and provides services designed to help senior Coloradans live full and healthy lives. By analyzing co-APCD data from a group of individuals who did not receive services compared to those who did, Dr. Cog is working to determine the influence their work has on the healthcare utilization and quality of life for older Coloradans. During this chat, we learn whether Dr. Cog realized a cost savings through the services provided and how the outcomes of the clients who received services differed from those not in the program. We recorded this chat in August 2017. Thanks for listening and enjoy the chat.
Good afternoon. Thank you for joining us today for Civic's monthly Change Agent Chat. I'm Carrie Frank and I'm Civic's VP of Communications and Marketing. And I'm very excited to be hosting our Change Agent Chat today with our guests here from Dr. Cog, and I will introduce them here in a second. But before I do that, I would like to just get started with some housekeeping items. We want to make sure you all know that your phone lines are muted today, and we'll be discussing or we'll be using your Q&A feature that's actually on your chat box there on your screen, and that's how we will allow you to enter in some questions. We'll be taking all of those questions at the end of our 20 minutes here, at the end of our intro, and we'll be discussing those chat questions with you later. This webinar is being recorded and will be posted to the Civic site, so you can have access to this anytime you would like at any without any cost. So the reason that we started these change agent chats earlier this year, because we really believe that the definition of insanity, like many of you heard, is doing the same thing over and over and over again, but expecting different results. And in the case of American healthcare, that means if we don't change what we're doing, we will keep spending twice as much money as our industrial competitors and still getting worse results. Civic and other like-minded organizations across the state, including our guests today and the nation, know that we can do better, and that the different and better ways of doing things are unlikely to come from some central plan, not ours, not Washington's, not anybody's. But instead, we believe that innovation in the 21st century is likely to come from the local level, in particular in communities where people find innovative ways to work with each other. And we are, as Civic, are aware of many Colorado examples, and with limited resources, these change agents are starting to deliver on the promise of the triple aim of better cost, better care, and a lower cost, better care, and better quality of life. We're excited to bring awareness to and amplify the work of these innovative people and organizations so we might get smarter together. And today, our smart people are here in the room with us. We're very excited to have our guests from the Denver Regional Council of Governments, also known as Dr. Cog. Dr. Cog is the federally designated Area Agency on Aging, also named as AAA, and provides services designed to help senior Coloradans live full and healthy lives. By analyzing the Colorado All Payer Claims database data from a group of individuals who do not receive AAA services compared to those who they have provided services to, Dr. Cog is working to determine the influence their work has on healthcare utilization and the quality of life of older Coloradans. We're very excited to have our guests AJ here today and Xavier, and I'm going to have them introduce themselves and their titles, and because they have very exciting last names as well, which I'm scared to pronounce. So thank you guys for coming. If you want to start, AJ, and let us know who you are.
Sure. My name is AJ Diamantopoulos, and I work in the Area Agency on Aging. I am a senior management analyst, and I work on the Accountable Health Communities grant as well as business development.
And I am Xavier Gitio. I'm an economist for the Regional Council of Government, and I work on many analysis, including healthcare and whatever ATF brings to my, on my plate. But we do also like development, economic development, transportation, real estate markets, all of those kind of urban economics type of things.
Thank you. Well, thank you guys for being here. I know summer is a busy time for everyone, so thanks for joining us today in person. My first question is, I know when I first heard of Dr. Cog, it was over a decade ago, and I thought, oh, who is this person delivering healthcare? I'm sure that you get that a lot. So just for people who don't know who Dr. Cog is and what you guys do, especially not really related to direct medical care, but
right.
You just let people know, you know, what kind of services you do offer to the seniors and your eight counties.
Sure. So the Area Agency on Aging works in, as you said, the eight-county region around Denver. We are the largest area agency on aging in the state. We cover the most urban and the most rural population. But we provide direct services to people, people 60 years of age and older, through things like community-based case management, our information and assistance line. We have a program for veterans. We have a options counselors, which are people who visit someone in their home just once and help them develop a plan to overcome any barriers that they might face, both in the healthcare world, but also things like housing affordability, food insecurity, things of that nature. And that's the Area Agency on Aging. And then, I should also say, we also provide contracted services. A lot of organizations contract with us to deliver services like Meals on Wheels, transportation for people 60 and over, things like that, over 30 services with, I think, 40 different providers. So it's quite a network that we have throughout the region.
Wonderful. So when you were initially developing, or as you've been implementing services that are focused mainly on health and wellness and keeping your population healthy, what were some of the goals that you guys, established to try and improve?
In the Area Agency on Aging, as the federally designated AAA, our overall goal is to keep people in their homes and communities as long as possible. It's otherwise known as age in place. It's the best place for people to be, because that's where they choose to be. That was our overarching goal. And we also have a direction to serve those most in need. The unserved and underserved is the most poetic regulatory language I've ever heard. But that's who before we got the claims data, we were hoping we were serving, and then we found out that was true. So that was very nice to learn.
I feel like a lot of people who provide services, organizations like yourself that provide services that are aimed at keeping people out of the healthcare system, mm-hmm. it's really hard to measure those prevention services. So, stopping things from bad things from happening is hard to demonstrate. So tell me how you guys are measuring the impact of your services on the health.
So we started like 2 years ago trying to figure out what really we do like quantitatively, because we wanted to bring numbers to the policymakers and say, look, this is the impact. So to do so, that the first thing we did actually, that was coming here and getting you all payer claims database. And the idea was, let's look at the people we serve, let's look at the health trajectory, and let's look if we change that trajectory over time when we do our intervention. So that's the way we thought about, approaching that issue. We realized, so during the process, that it's more complicated than that. We did more work to get there, because the first thing we realized, and I think Ajay already touched it, is that the people we serve are not the random or the adults. It's not the random sample. It's actually the people, they came to us because they're in need of services. And because of that, the people we serve, they look worse. The health is worse than the average person. They are much more likely to have a chronic disease, to have diabetes, to have cancer. They are much more likely to have high healthcare expenses. So when we compare them to like the the rest of the all the other population that looks much worse. And that's the first challenge, is to make people realize there's a lot of selection in those services, and you cannot go and compare them to the average seniors. So you got to be creative to be able to do that comparison. So that's one thing we observe. Now, I think we didn't know it, but we may have saw it before, but we didn't have like data. And the first thing that we did, the ABCD data, the old payer claims data, did to us is that realization, we serve people that are on the sale, and we would actually do it. And that was high opening for us. So that's where we started.
It's great to learn.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was eye opening, and we saw, okay, this is now it's going to be difficult to do a comparison like apple to apple, so we've got to be creative. So we're seeing the process of that type of research to get to the actual impact on what do we really do to these people in terms of health and healthcare behavior, and where do we really have an impact? Do we have an impact on the expenses? Do we have an impact on behavior? The more, you know, we provide transportation, are they more likely to go to regular checkups, to do the regular, with your diabetes, you have to have some scheduled checkup as well. Are they doing it more? What would help them? Is the food helping their nutrition outcomes in terms of, I don't know, anemia or osteoporosis and things like that? This is really where we started looking more carefully at those outcomes.
Yeah, that's really interesting that one of the outcomes is actually that your population is very different. Just realizing that, I think, is a really interesting outcome. Evaluating the data. So are you going to consider trying to put together a control group that looks closer to your population?
So the experience with the control group so far would be good, and we're not the only one looking for that. I think there's a researcher like out to Brown University trying to build a control group that would look a lot like, but it doesn't really exist. So I think the way actually, because the ABCD data tells you a lot of medical things. I mean, actually, it only tells you medical things, and you have to infer the rest. I think the way we're going to look at it, and we observe that the medical provider are a channel sort of errors, so you're more likely to come to us if actually you go to a doctor that historically is more likely to, you know, refer clients to us. So we will compare the people that go to doctor who are more likely to, you know, refer clients to us to the people that go to the doctor that historically has no contact with us. That may give us a little bit of that control versus treatment group. Yes, and that makes sense using that data because this is all medical. So the only information we get out of the data is always medically related. So it makes sense to use providers, I mean, whatever we can out directly of that data.
And I laughed when you asked that question because a control group is a non-starter with the AAA and Dr. Cog, because when someone tells us they need a service, well, we do our best to get that service. We can't say,
you're in our control.
We selected you for a special set aside, but please report to us every month. So it is hard to define that population and say, these are people who would normally benefit from our services but aren't using them, because that's kind of a black wall for us. So we're working to identify something much like
Zahia said. So with some of the challenges you've had with the data, have you been able to come up with some results that you can at least speak to qualitatively, I'm sure?
We actually had on the very narrow population, which are the older adult refugees. Mm-hmm. So I think we serve about 120, I check, as it's part of one of our programs. So we look at them more carefully, and we realize that they have a healthcare pattern that doesn't look like anyone else in the region, because they don't really go to the doctor. We found that very few of them go to the doctor for preventive care, and most of the contact with the medical system is for hospitalization. We found that 14% of the claim has to do with something that is not hospitalization. And then we also found that when they go to the hospital, they are in really bad shape because they stay on average 9 days, which is very long stay in hospital. And I think almost half of their claims has to do with morbidity or death. And the thing is, because there is a cultural probably gap where they don't used to go on regular checkups, and they come here in the US probably with already medical conditions that need to be treated regularly, and they don't do it. we know you can see patterns and behavior that are actually end up being costly to the system. And so we rippled that, and I think we got funding to actually take care of that population and be able to, you know, not, you know, help them, you know, are speaking to for the integration in the community, but especially the interaction with the medical system to try to, you know, reduce that, change that pattern, which is extremely costly if you don't actually do this preventive care along the way.
Yeah. So is that the population that you're seeing typically that overall they tend to not access the prevention services more than any of the other people that you serve as refugees?
I think when you first found this, you came to us and said they had, like, between the whole group, there was, like, two primary care visits or some, I'm not sure. But and we use that information in an application for our reauthorization for funding to serve this population. And we included things like we bought, I forget the name of it, but passes to the exercise center at the Aurora Center for Older Adults. And there's popular Zumba classes that they really like. So when the data translates into actual work, it's pretty satisfying. And I'm not sure where they're at on the education piece of teaching them. You know, there's a process for healthcare that they benefit from. But the navigators are working with them a lot.
So what would you say is the biggest contributing factor to the success of your programs in general?
The data? I think it changed the culture a little bit. It's a lot of social workers and they work with the heart. They believe in the guts that, you know, they do the God's work. But I think that there was a first step, the first initiative we took to actually put numbers or try to put numbers on this, and I opened a lot of eyes. Oh, my, you can do a lot of things when you bring numbers. You can try to tease out these specific population and specific behavior that you probably want to know if you want to have a more effective use of your resources. You can demonstrate, or we can tend, you know, try to demonstrate what's the impact on some healthcare trajectory. And also, I think that's probably actually the most important piece is that people look up to us now. Like, there's a sense of, oh, they are much more sophisticated than they used to be. When we talk about what we think we do to this population, we bring this number on the table, and that suddenly all the agencies across the state look up to us and want to partner with us, want to work with us. While in the past, they were like thinking, okay, those are the well-intending, warm, glowing type of individual that want to help, you know, but they don't have any, like, rational quantitative ground to support what they do. And I think we start changing a little bit that conversation. That's probably important for us and also for the, you know, the old programs, because you give it like a more sophisticated type of feeling, like, oh, this is actually sales, this is more evidence-based.
It has been interesting. So I work in the areas in town aging, and our desks are all together, and I was really the first one to start working outside of that with the other divisions. Give you an example. I came across one of our social workers the other day, or a couple of years ago, I should say, doing this on their Excel spreadsheet. And I said, what are you doing? And she said, I'm adding it up. So that was our level of sophistication. And then I walked across the hall, and there's Zavi and his team doing high level mathematics. And I was like, well, maybe we should talk. and so it has changed, as Zavi said, some of the culture. We still are focused on the people we serve first, but in how we collect the data and what we do with it afterwards has changed quite a bit. We're now better at actually documenting the work we do, which is nice.
And so what have you learned, and what, like, changes are you actually implementing based on the data that you have seen?
I think from the data perspective, we actually try to do more now. We're starting looking at the trends, evidence-based type of trend, before we talk about the
health
communities. We apply to also evidence-based type of trends, because we think there is value to that, to demonstrate, take a program and demonstrate what we do. For example, two years ago, we had a program that was run by our AAA, helping older adults out of the hospital back to the communities. And they run the program, collect data, did nothing. No quantitative analysis, no demonstration, no understanding even what did it really work, what it did, what did it change. So we now look back at it and say, okay, let's, you know, bring medical day claims data from Medicaid or Medicare, let's bring all the data we collect, put it together, and let's look at what it actually did. And that thing that's, we changed perspective, we realized we could do a lot with that. If we could understand what the program does, it's very cheap, you know, $400 a patient for a month of transition care. If it does a lot to those patients, then we should probably demonstrate that. So I think this is the new, like, mantra, credo now. Let's try to, like, really emphasize what we do and how and what the impact is, or what the impact is not, to clarify a little bit what we do exactly, because I think before we don't really know what was the impact at all.
I think we are going to go to some questions, if we have any questions in the chat. All right, we have actually a comment, so I'm going to toss it out there and let you guys run with it. Since we are able to identify the clients with multiple ADLs or IADLs, we can estimate that a significant percentage of that population would wind up in costly long-term residential facilities. We can also project that basic preventive measures, education, access to food, security, having a primary care provider, and gentle exercise will likely have a positive impact, reducing risks of long-term placement while saving healthcare costs.
Yeah, so ADLs are activities of daily living or instrumental activities of daily living. And so there are things like I haven't worked on them in years, but things like being able to cook for yourself is an instrumental ADL. And that is true. We have found, we've known for a long time, and I think we're finding through the data, the confirmation of it, that it doesn't, in some cases, it doesn't take a lot to keep somebody in their home. Something like a ramp so they can get in and out, or a grab bar so they feel more confident getting in and out of the shower, so they actually are more hygienic, or a ride to the grocery store, to church, to their doctor's appointment. Those have exponential effects on people's ability to live the life that they want to live. And it is true that just a little bit goes a long way. And we're working, as funding, I wouldn't say it's decreasing, but it's not increasing as it goes, our client load is increasing. As our resources are stretched, we're trying to be more efficient, but also make the argument, the fair argument, that the work we do really does decrease the cost of healthcare. It avoids a lot of things, because I used to call it the red notice roulette. Once you get into that game, you become somebody who becomes more expensive for all the different systems you encounter. So if your utilities get turned off, if you have medication that's refrigerated, you have issues. Now, there's a program to prevent them from turning off your utilities if you have medication to be refrigerated, but it takes it has to be reauthorized every year. A lot of people don't know that. So there's these types of things. And, you know, if your insulin goes bad, you're going to the ER, so that's more expensive for healthcare. But once you have the healthcare bill, you may not be able to pay your rent or your mortgage, and so that's more expensive for the judicial system and for all the other folks, the landlords. So there are those ripple effects that those little interventions really do help.
We found that 25% of a client, we almost sell them every day. So you got to think of what would happen if we don't, because we deliver a meal every day. So this is people that if they we were not here, we don't exactly know what would happen to them. And we also found that looking at the data, we are very much the transition between aging and you're okay because you're still in shape, and aging when things are much more difficult. We really the transition in terms of all healthcare indicator between the people they are independent by themselves, we don't save, and the people we are in longer term facilities. We are, you know, we kind of bridge in between, and the question is, you know, by how much further we can go, but we really that transition between different in the life cycle of the older adult.
So a lot of what you guys provide, obviously, is social, like what people talk about is social determinants of health. And I was just curious if you've found it's hard to like place a value that one is higher than the other, but you know, obviously you guys provide food almost on a daily basis, housing, transportation, all the things. Would you say that there are top two that you think are like the most utilized services that you have and most,
well,
quote unquote, important?
I wouldn't say important. We could rank them based on something like a diagnosis, but our most utilized services are transportation and food. So we provide Meals on Wheels and also the congregate dining centers, which help. But also the transportation, that's what we fund at the highest levels and what's used the most. But, you know, if somebody is having issues, you know, if they're on dialysis, transportation is, of course, their most important because they have to get to dialysis 3 times a week. But if they're having food insecurity, which, you always hear the story about the person who can't take a certain medication because they don't have food at the right amount of time or enough food to take with that medication. So that would be the most important service to them. But we're looking at, I think our next step is the basket of services that would most impact certain states of health the most in our effort to be more efficient.
And I think you guys also mentioned some other data sources besides the Colorado Healthcare Claims Database and maybe what you guys pull into. What other Colorado data sources, or do you use other data sources to evaluate your work? I know sometimes you have to pull from a lot of areas to really get to the heart of what you're needing.
Well, so we're federally designated as a AAA, and then there's a state's component to it, the State Unit on Aging and the Department of Human Services. And they operate a database called SAMHS, the Social Assistance Management System. I think I got that right.
Good.
Yeah, and it is a statewide database of all the area agencies on aging that they put in their information on the people they've assessed and served. And so that's what we use to match with the APCD to start the work on this.
And so we just got rewarded a grant from the CMI, the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Innovation. And one of the goals of that grant is to like generate a data ecosystem that will link more data, the medical claims, community-based organization data, who they serve, when, how, and we try to think out of the box, so maybe school data, we want to see what's the effect of our services we serve to the parents, what's the effect on the kids in school, how they perform. We're going to try to link to even more out of the box, looking at judicial database, where we can find if there's more eviction, less eviction when we make an intervention. So really, we try to think, you know, to create an ecosystem we can link all this data together and get momentum for everyone, because it's all about everyone agreeing, okay, we need to link this data, everyone has its own silo of data, and we try to start working on making this data talk to each other, and those people talk to each other as well.
And so you're able to benchmark your performance against other area agencies across the state, and can you do that nationally too, or?
No. The nature of the funding doesn't. I think we might be able to, but I'm not sure if it's data that matches across state borders in terms of, you know, what data points they collect and how we would match that. But you know, when we started talking about getting this claims data, everybody got excited because it's kind of the hot button issue of the social determinants of health and with, you know, payment reform in healthcare. And everybody's at kind of at the same point of they're doing some initial analysis, but they know there's that other thing. So we're looking to find all of them and see if we can be that other thing for them and they can be it for us, and we can match up across the state to really build out the data set so we can do that analysis.
Wonderful. Do we have any more questions? Well, great. I want to thank you guys so much for being here, and thanks for sharing your great work. And this will be recorded, as we mentioned earlier, and available on our website. We'll be pushing it out through social media probably Monday, so you can look for it on our YouTube. next chat is Friday, September 8th, when we'll be chatting with Brigham and Women's Hospital about how they are studying skin cancer prevalence across the nation. Thanks again and have a